from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, after his 20-year marriage ended in divorce, Stanford economics professor Paul Oyer decided to try online dating. His economic sensibilities helped him navigate the online profiles and understand trends in dating preferences. In the process, he found that the online dating market offers a useful case study for teaching economics to novices. He'll join us to talk about his new book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Paul Oyer is professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's also editor-in-chief of the Journal of Labor Economics and the author of a book called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And this all began after he went through a divorce and decided to go online to look for a life partner. And as he points out in his book, a lot of people go online not necessarily to look for life partners, but look for other things, casual things, let's say. He found out that by identifying himself as being separated, he faced a particular, let's say, handicap of sorts. And so he began to think about, well, this is a market, and what can I learn about this in terms of microeconomics, which is his field? And 10 big ideas came out of it, and that's the book. And so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is let's begin where you begin, the idea of utility. I mean, how you plan your day and everything. I mean, this is a kind of elemental economic concept, and it gets into how you spend your time online with online dating.
Yeah, I mean, utility is both the most abstract and, I think, the most intuitive idea we have in economics. It's right up there, if not the most. And, you know, we're constantly running around trying to think about how to make ourselves happier and making little decisions. And so you think there's psychological sides of that as well, but from a straightforward how do I make myself happier type of thing, you want to try to figure out how to maximize utility. That is, you want to make decisions that maximize the benefits of those of your actions and minimize the costs. And it's
doing, as you say, what you need or want to do.
Doing, yeah, exactly. And of course, this is all based on expected utility. So you often have to make decisions without knowing what's going to become of them. And sometimes you make decisions that turn out to be wrong in the end, but were actually sensible at the time, right? And you might think, well, what does that have to do with looking for a mate? Because that sounds so romantic and so forth. But it's the same principle. When you get online, you're thinking about how am I going to use my time on this website in an efficient way to maximize the possibility of finding the type of mate I'm looking for, while still keeping in mind that I have to go wash the dishes and get my kids to school and all sorts of other things.
Especially since there are sort of endless prospects. I mean, there are a lot who use online dating just keep sampling here and going on and on. But you were looking for a partner, and yet you identified yourself as separated and realized, as I said earlier, that was a kind of disability.
Yeah, I mean, so that brings up an economic principle of what's known as statistical discrimination, and it's also tied into another idea in the book called adverse selection. If you identify yourself as separated, I was naive. I just sort of put myself as separated because that's what I was on a website. And then you begin to find out that people make associations. There's a stereotype that goes along with saying you're separated. And that is, you know, there are some people who just plain don't, for moral reasons or whatever, won't date a separated man. But there are a lot of other people, and I would get emails from them saying, you seem like a nice guy, the kind of person I might want to meet, but I don't date separated men because they turn out to often be just total wrecks. Or they go back to their wives. And so it's not that they had any, and the reason that's called statistical discrimination is it's not that those people had anything against me because I was separated. It's that they associate separated with something else. And it's very much, that's the exact same economic principle that has much, so in my case, what was the big deal? I waited a few months and found some, you know, I don't claim that as a sob story at all. It's a good illustration of economics, but it wasn't a big problem. But the places where you do get into problems are, it's the exact same principle that leads employers to look at a 25-year-old woman and say, you know what, I have to be careful about hiring this woman because she might start having children soon, and that's going to be costly to me. And so it's the same principle that women were applying when deciding whether or not to date me, which didn't have that big an effect. I would be the first to admit, has much bigger effects in other cases. Racial profiling is the same sort of idea.
But you made the analogy to job seeking, and there's a lot there. I mean, you also talk about, you know, you're looking for a house, for example, and you have to be utility minded in terms of your time and your time expansion. But with respect to jobs, like with respect to mates, both have to agree. And there's a lot at stake here. I mean, as you point out, you know, it may be unemployment with a job, but it may be loneliness if you can't find the right partner. So in some ways, I think, in fact, you've indicated the that Monster.com and LinkedIn could learn a lot from this principle.
Yeah, I mean, I think both are learning a lot from one another. Monster.com and LinkedIn are learning from Match.com and vice versa. They're essentially the same product. There are these websites that are matching two sides. And you said you made the important distinction. So we can learn a lot about other markets from online dating. But I think the job market is where the parallel is most apt, because both sides have to accept each other. So if I go to buy a house, there, you know, sometimes there are multiple offers and you have to impress the bidder and stuff. But for the most part, if I buy a house or a pair of jeans, the house and the pair of jeans don't have to love me back. If I go to apply for a job, the employer has to want me back. And, you know, in the book, chapter after chapter draws parallels to the labor market. And that's probably why all of this occurred to me. I'm a labor economist. I've been studying how firms match to workers for, you know, going on 20 years now. So those parallels overwhelmed me as I jumped back into this market.
And again, Paul Oyer is professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. His book is called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. He'll be speaking in the spring, actually April 10th, at the Galleria Park Hotel in San Francisco at 6:30 p.m. You might want to make a note of that to go hear him there at that time. There's also this notion that actually came up in a program we did with a modern love editor in the New York Times, that everybody on the internet on online dating lies or exaggerates. And you talk about talk being cheap and the competition perhaps is lying and exaggerating. So the rule of thumb should be exaggerate, but not too much. And yet, interestingly enough, when we had that conversation on the air with Daniel Jones from the New York Times, somebody called in and sounded a little bit petulant at the fact that, well, you know, I met somebody online, I told the truth, he told the truth, and we wound up together. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, from your studies and from everything I hear anecdotally, people about their income, about their age, about all kinds of things will fudge the truth. Now, there's a Korean online facility that, in fact, let's talk about the idea of signaling, because that comes in here, you know.
Sure.
And there are ways to signal, but there are also ways to check the signaling in terms of what the truth is.
Right. So the two economic principles you've thrown out there are models of what's called cheap talk, which a normal person, a non-economist, would talk about lying. And from an economist perspective, we say people think about how much they're going to tell the truth, and then they rationally, sometimes irrationally, but if you just take the start from the simplest world, they rationally think about, okay, I want to stretch the truth such that I can get something out of it. And so in the online dating world, that means I'm going to say I'm a little younger than I am because the person's not going to notice that.
Or put a photograph in
or
me,
put a
much younger or something.
Or put a photograph. And the studies are very clear on this. I wouldn't go so far as say everybody's lying, but there's quite a bit of lying on websites. And so this leads to two things to think about. One is the people you mentioned who said, I don't lie. Nobody should lie. And I would never tell anybody to lie. That's up to you. And it's between you and your conscience, shall we say. But you do have to keep in mind that your competition is lying. And so these people who were incredulous on the call-in the other day, the woman you said who and her husband was very honest and so forth, that's great. And if everybody were like that, the internet would actually be the online dating world would be more efficient in many ways. But realistically, that's not the way it works. And so there have been two different things done by a Korean dating site. They've done two different things to try to get around this issue of lying online. One is that Korean dating site requires you to submit certain information in order to be on their site.
Documentation.
So you have to send them your I don't know the exact, but something like your driver's license, which has both your age and your height on it, for example. I don't know if they require your tax return. That seems like it would be asking for a bit much. But, so, you know, further information along those lines. So one thing you can do, and we only see this, as far as I know, in a couple of Asian sites in Korea and China, these sites have said you have to document these things. And then that makes the market work better. Now, that changes the entire business model of the online dating sites, because the online dating sites business model is all about the fixed cost of setting up this efficient online software, which then takes care of everything from there. And now you've changed the business into one where somebody, some individual laborer, has to go out and do the work of verifying each piece of information. So the economics are better from an efficiency perspective, from an outside economics perspective. But in terms of the guy in the middle trying to make money, the guy running a website, it's hard to work that out. So that hasn't caught on as well here in the U.S., where labor costs are much higher.
Didn't something occur? You mentioned China, because a woman was swindled.
Yes. Yeah, so China, the Chinese site that requires you to verify information. I think there are two reasons they do it in China, in this particular site in China. I don't know for a fact exactly what drove this, but first of all, they get a lot of bad PR after a woman was swindled by somebody who claimed to be somebody he was not on this website. And then the second reason this might work in China and not here is, again, as I mentioned, the labor costs are just much lower in China. So to get somebody to verify these pieces of information might make the business model work out better. Now, you started getting at the idea of signaling, which is so now if we think about cheap talk as I can say anything I want and we don't know exactly who's lying and who's not, signaling, and this is a model in economics that's been used in many different contexts. It was developed by a guy named Mike Spence, who's won the Nobel Prize for it about 10 years ago. And the idea is, let's think about how I can show you that my talk isn't cheap. How do I put my money where my mouth is? And so in the online dating context, a couple of economists talked this Korean dating site into trying the following experiment. And I think a job board should try this, because I think the stakes are even higher in the job market for this type of thing. They said, you can send a message to anybody you want on our website, but over a certain period of time, you can also send up to two what they called virtual roses. And that now says, now if I send a message that says, hey, I want to meet you, that's kind of cheap talk and the usual problems happen there. But if I send a message with a virtual rose, it says, I really want to meet you. Well, now maybe I'm still lying about my height, but at least you do know that I'm interested in you.
It's a special category.
You've expended a cost because you only get to send two of these, and now you can't send them to anybody else. So it's a way of essentially putting your money where your mouth is. There are many other contexts in which signaling is very valuable. Another one people are always fascinated about is college admissions.
Yeah, you make the analogy.
Early admissions have all sorts of other problems, and maybe they're not a good idea, but they do one good thing, which is they allow the person to signal to that college, I've thought this through and I've decided I really want to go to your college because you're the only college I'm applying to early. I'm only allowed to do this to one place. And so hopefully that helps the market a little bit.
I was fascinated in the signaling chapter to read an economist who studies signals says high school dropouts who invest in GED degrees are rewarded for the trouble they go through to get those degrees, even though there's no evidence to suggest they gain any valuable skills in the process.
Right. So what you're doing when you get a GED is you're showing people not just that I now have a high school equivalent education, but you're actually showing them something different, which is I took the trouble to go through the effort of getting a GED, which takes time and it's costly and so forth. And so people view the signal. That if you read a little further in that chapter, you get to a rather dour side fact there, which is, you know, one of the reasons we're known as dismal sciences, because we always have these dour findings. It shows that African Americans don't get that same bump sometimes from the GED, because a lot of GEDs are given in prisons, it turns out. So when you if you're African American and you get a GED, it also comes with the signal that I might be in jail while I'm earning this. And that has a negative connotation on the job market.
Well, there was also this study that you reference about Jews and Arabs in Israel and car buying, and a study actually about blacks and whites and those with tattoos on their arms. I mean, talk about all that, because, again, it really shows a rather fundamental notion of how people do discriminate.
Right. So now we're coming back to the idea of statistical discrimination. And so as there's a couple of economists have been, we know that there's a lot of discrimination in the marketplace, in the job market. You know, I'm a labor economist, so I'm always, we see a lot of evidence there. Now, there's an ongoing debate in economics about, for example, women make, I don't know, 20% less, I don't know what the number is these days, than men for with the same education and so forth. And there's an ongoing debate in economics about how much of that is based on differences in skills and choices and so forth. But we also all sort of acknowledge that there's some degree of discrimination going on there. And then the question becomes, how much of it is taste-based discrimination or just actual animus? I don't, as an employer, I prefer men to women. And how much of it is, I associate women with certain qualifications or certain traits that are going to make them less productive, like going off to have babies. Okay, and that's a fact. Women in their 20s are more likely to take a break in their careers than men are. And so we haven't had as much success. You can't run a controlled experiment. So what you'd ideally like to do, of course, is take some women and men and randomly assign them to have babies or not have babies. And you could design some sort of social experiment to determine how much discrimination is going on in the labor market. Well, you know, that would be fun and interesting from an economist's perspective, but those experiments aren't always in the best interest of society as a whole, and it's hard to get employers to run those type of experiments, and it's probably a good thing that they don't happen. So instead, we run other sorts of experiments to try to get at the degree to which people are have discrimination that's taste-based versus actual just animus. And one of the ones you mentioned that I think is really interesting was in Israel, an economist... He sent out messages to people who listed cars for sale on the Israeli equivalent of Craigslist saying, I will pay you such and such amount for the car. And he would randomly assign that these would be signed, that these would be, these emails would be signed by a guy named Moshe, which is a very Israeli Jewish name, and somebody named Muhammad or something like that, which was a distinctly Arab name. And of course, people's reactions, not surprisingly, were very different based on which name you gave them. And so that doesn't tell you whether they were against, whether they just didn't like Arabs or whether they just had a hatred for Arabs or maybe they just associated certain things with Arabs. So this guy called up the exact same people who listed these cars for sale and ran a survey on them in which he asked them for their attitudes towards Arabs in certain ways without them having any idea that this was related to their car, to their selling of the car. So it was just a random, seemed like a random social survey of their attitudes towards Arabs. And lo and behold, he found that those who were sort of giving, who were less willing to engage with somebody named Muhammad, who were sort of displayed discrimination against Muslims, were the ones who said they were worried about Arabs. They were worried about Arabs cheating them. So it wasn't, you know, they didn't have any reaction such as, I think Arabs are worse people, but they would, on average, respond much more distinctly to the question, do you think Arabs will cheat me in business? And so that led him to believe in a taste-based discrimination rather than any sort of animus. The American study you mentioned is really interesting. They sold, people put iPods up for sale on Craigslist or the equivalent, and they showed a hand holding it, and they looked, and if the hand holding it was white, they got a much better reaction than if the hand holding it was black, was obviously an African-American hand. And with a little bit of trying to figure out differences across regions, they also attribute most of this to some sort of statistical discrimination rather than taste-based discrimination.
Our guest is Paul Oyer, and again, he's professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, author of Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And, you know, you get into this notion that bigger sites well, thicker markets, so it's better maybe to limit your options based on the criteria that are very important to you. And all these, again, essentials of economics. And yet you're present significant other was only 100 yards away from you, turned out.
Well, but I think the way my relationship developed is sort of illustrates the point about the importance of thinking about markets in this area where people wouldn't normally think about markets very carefully. So my girlfriend works 100 yards away from me. We had friends and acquaintances in common. We lived in Princeton for several years at the same time. Our children were born in the same hospital, and we had the same pediatrician, and we had friends in common there, and we have friends in common here. Well, we'd never met each other, or at least we'd never known we were, and we'd probably passed each other regularly. And so why online dating was a success from an economist's perspective for me is the market was online. Walking around every day, I run into people all the time, and but very few of them are looking to have a relationship, much less would be a good fit for me and so forth. So I'm walking around in a thin market for potential mates and talking to people, and I might run, if I keep going, I'll run into somebody eventually, and we'll figure out that it's a good relationship. But instead, I took the principle of find the thick market for what I was looking for, which was in this case a life partner that I would be compatible with. So I went to a site. I went to various sites where I thought I would find that. And indeed, it turned out the person was only 100 yards away, but we probably would have gone the rest of our lives barely knowing each other despite that.
Can you talk a little bit, we're coming up on a break, about network externalities?
Network externalities. Yeah, I love to talk about externalities. I'm an economist. Network externality. So when we think about demand, you usually think about demand for a product being driven by the price and the qualities of that product. But a product has a network externality if there's a third quality that plays into how much people demand it, and that is how much other people demand it. So Facebook's entire success, that's a little too simple, but Facebook's success is largely based on a network externality. That is, people go to Facebook because people go to Facebook. And that's an odd, if you can get your business to work that way, you've got it made. And so, the same is true for Match.com. People go to Match.com because people go to Match.com.
It's a lot of branding, isn't it, too?
Well, it is branding. It's branding, but that's part of
the idea of network externality.
Yeah. That's part of it is based on brand. But you can have a brand like Coke where, sure, people go, you drink Coke because they want to look like the other people, or people wear Abercrombie clothes because they want to look like the other people. But a true network externality is one where it would be very hard for a new entrant to come in and change everybody over. So Abercrombie can go out of style and we can all switch our clothes pretty quickly. The brands are more, but for Facebook to go out of style is going to be much harder because you have to get your entire network of friends to get up and move to Google+ and so forth. So Google+, many people claim has better features than Facebook, but Google year after year tries a different social networking product, and they have great trouble making inroads on Facebook.
And the same reason all these different servers try to get more people not to go to Google, but to go to them.
Exactly. So Google has some of that as well. Although if you had a better search product, Google would be in trouble, whereas not with Facebook.
Paul Ayer is our guest, and you can join us. In fact, you're cordially invited to do that. What about these analogies between economics and markets and online dating? And some of you may have some online dating experiences you want to bring into the mix. Any questions or comments, you are welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number available to you now is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your involvement, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our handle's at @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. After a 20-year marriage that ended in divorce, Stanford economics professor Paul Ayer decided to try out online dating. And his economic sensibilities helped him navigate all those online profiles and understand trends and dating preferences in the process. He found that the online dating market offers a useful case study for teaching economics to novices, and over the years, that's proven to be true to him. So you can join us in this discussion. The book is called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating, and let's find out what you've learned from online dating, or find out what your thoughts are on the subject. Let me begin, Angela, with you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, and thank you so much for this discussion. My girlfriends and I have spent quite some time on online dating, and one of the things I wanted to refer to was your idea about signaling and the roses. We thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to improve our chances of finding men who are actually serious about having a relationship if they went through some program? We all went through some program where we were interested in relationships, communicating, and we passed some kind of certification process so that on our profile would be this signal, like a, you know, similar to the rose, that would where we would stand out as those individuals who'd gone kind of the extra mile and were really serious about relationship and serious about having a good relationship.
So kind of like what we said about a GED almost, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And actually, it would actually be a good sort of, I was thinking of it more as a business model too, but I don't know, maybe it works against the model that a lot of dating sites have, that maybe they just want you to stay on there.
What do you think, Paul here?
I like this idea very much, and it reminds me, I'm a labor...
You get some of your venture capitalists on Silicon Valley?
So I'm a labor economist, and this sounds like a labor market type of thing. So if you go to a temporary agency, if temporary agencies, which are matching firms to employees, which is very much like the intermediary matching people, they do this, right? So you can earn little credentials for using Excel. Or you can go to, if you're an engineer on certain sites, you can show proficiency with some language, which the employer would see. Now, I have to, as an economist, of course, I'd have to step aside in designing your actual test. That's what I'm a little worried about, Angela, is how would you get this test? How could you do the test in a way that couldn't be gamed? So, you know, if you did it, if you asked questions that were yes and no, or how do you feel about these things, people would know what the right answer is, I think. So I love the idea. I think the implementation could be difficult, but I think it's actually a great idea. And as far as whether it would be the right business model for the websites, I could easily imagine there would be one website where all that, you know, this would help separate this, the websites where people, men were serious about relationships and where they weren't. So I could imagine at least one of them thinking this was a good idea.
But they already do have kind of niche websites, speaking about markets. I mean, you can go on a website to find someone, for example, who's a super performing athlete, if you're a super performing athlete, or someone who's a millionaire, if you have $1 million, that sort of thing.
Right. And these niche sites are very useful for certain types of people who have very strong tastes about what they're looking for. And this is a big enough, and so it only works when the niche is big enough, like Christian Mingles is very successful and things like that. And I think the niche of men and women looking for serious relationships would work. Let me point out one other way to solve your, potentially solve your problem, Angela. Have you been to this website called Lulu?
Yeah, she's not on the air
okay,
anymore.
Well, anyway,
tell us about Lulu.
Off the air, I'll suggest something called, I believe the address is onlulu.com. And it's a place where women go to rate men. So instead of signaling in any way, it becomes just like eBay, where you give stars to how the people you buy and sell from. On Lulu,
this
you
has
give...
caused immense controversy, though, because of bitter women, supposedly, or women who have enmity.
Exactly. And so you could imagine that this isn't the way to solve this problem in this market. We love references on the job market. They have their own sets of problems, for sure, but they can be at least somewhat useful. We love references on eBay. But I completely agree. This may not be the way to solve this. And I'll tell you... Yelp for single men. And I opted out of, I mean, I'm not on the market anymore, but just to, you know, keep anybody from saying anything about me, I opted out of On Lulu, which you're allowed to do. And so some men may want to go ahead and do that.
It's amazing, though, how people use the language. I remember a woman friend of mine who met a guy after her husband died, a guy who had been through a divorce. She said, I took myself off the market, Michael. I mean, people actually talk that way now, don't they?
Wow.
Become part of the vernacular.
Nothing makes an economist smile more than hearing that.
It's nice to see a dismal scientist smile. Let me get another caller on here. Genevieve joins us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Genevieve. So I actually have a couple comments to make. One is I met my husband on Match.com, and oddly enough, I was one of those people who had a super honest profile, and he had probably the most minimal profile I'd seen around. However, the connections I was able to make with him from the information, like his political perspective and his religious background, really helped me make that decision to stay with him and want to be with him. And all the people I've met out in the real world In fact, religion and political perspective has been one of the major hindrances to the relationship. So I love the ability to see that information up front. I've been an advocate for online dating since early 2000s when it started off. And then I have another comment about, I work with many of my friends who are online daters, and we've sort of established that there's a method to writing your messages to people. And if you don't get the key message in the first line of your email, you're most likely not even going to have that message opened up in the first place. So we've been trying to, quote-unquote, game the system by focusing on that first introductory line that appears on your cell phone or your email, one-line visibility. So.
Well, thank you for those comments, Genevieve, and good to hear from you. And here's another Angela in Los Gatos who writes, I had a terrible experience with online dating until I met my husband. The big change was that I took out all the white lies that made me sound good and wrote all the things I was looking for in a partner. I went from making myself seem widely attractive to scaring off everyone except the kind of man I was looking for. It worked. I met my husband. We were married a year later. That was 8 years ago. And I tell everyone I know to be honest in online dating. You get fewer responses, but you get what you want.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's clearly the case, and both of these calls made this point, the religion and the other issue that was a deal breaker for Genevieve. Both Angela and Genevieve have made a very important point.
You said her name right. Thank you. I said Genevieve.
From a game theory perspective, in these cheap talk games we're talking about, when the game is what we call a coordination game, that is, when everybody's interests are aligned in getting to a long-term relationship, you want to be fully honest. And so you want to talk about the deal breakers right up front. That's for sure. So I think these principles, you know, these two people thought this through and figured it out, and that's great.
And here I think we're transitional to some extent with Jonathan, our next caller. Good morning, Jonathan. You're on forum.
Hi there. So I am 49. I have an online dating profile.
And are you really 49?
I really am 49, but I look like I'm in my 30s. And, you know, if I put on there that I'm 49, I don't get much response. And on the other hand, I really don't like to lie, but I'd love to hear what The Economist has to say about this, because I tried an experiment. My experiment was I lowered my age, but inside my profile, I actually tell the truth. And what happened is, first, I just started this, so I don't have any, I don't have a lot of data. But the first person who responded said, I don't like people who lie, I don't want to date you. So I'm wondering what you have to say about that.
Right. So what you're worried about here is if you, by lying in the part where you objectively state your, you know, in the questionnaire where you state your name, that's important because you're getting, that affects whose search engine comes up with you. So if you say you're 49, people who cut off at 45 are not going to see you. So, yeah, definitely there are, but you just pointed out there are people for whom any lying is a deal breaker. So you get to a bigger market by saying you're 44 or whatever you said you were, but you turn off other people. And like you said, you don't have enough data. Over time, you'll figure out whether or not that data is there. Now, I have good news for you, Jonathan, from an economist perspective, and that is 49 sounds like it's an unattractive age, but demographics are in your favor. As we age, you didn't say this. Maybe you did. Assuming we're talking about heterosexual sites, then the demographics are going to move in your favor. As we age, the supply of women relative to men grows. And so being 49 may not be all that attractive, but being 59 and in good shape
and looking
young. Unless
he's a 49-year-old who wants a 23-year-old.
Then. Well, that's true. So if you're looking for a 23-year-old, that is problematic. But on the other hand, it's not better or worse, not out of the question these days.
I just have to ask you a vital question that's been burning in me. Does your partner, your present girlfriend, significant other, she laugh at your jokes?
Yes, as I say in the book, that was a deal breaker. I had to keep looking till I found somebody who thought I was funny, and that was not easy. It took a lot of work. We laugh at each other's jokes. She's endlessly entertaining, and for some unknown reason is entertained by me as well.
We'll bring some more callers on. Jeff, thanks for waiting. Jeff joining us from Palo Alto. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. So my experience has been that relationships work better when the woman approaches the man, because the women get a lot of messages, so any guy who's approaching her is just one of 100 or 1,000. But when she finds someone she's interested in, actually connects to him, it stands out, and she's already essentially pre-screening.
And that's like the virtual rose in a way. Yeah.
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, the way to turn that around is, I think that's right. That sounds right. And I think one way to turn that around is when the man writes a message, I think rather than writing 100 messages that say, hey, I think you're cute, let's get together, I think it makes sense to take the same amount of time and write 10 messages that where you apply the idea of signaling a little bit, the virtual rose, where by showing you spent some time looking at the thing, or as one of the earlier callers said, in that first line getting across that you've thought through their profile, that's a form of signaling. So if you write to them and say, hey, I really like that movie, you know, that you mentioned, I love that movie too, or, you know, I love KQED. I have to tell you, Kate.
Especially the foreign program.
NPR on my OKCupid profile was one of the 6 things I said I couldn't live without. So you know, sometimes I would email somebody and say, hey, I love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me also. And that's a way of showing, hey, I at least spent 2 minutes thinking about whether we'd be a good match, which is a little bit of a signal.
Let me thank the caller. Here's Walter who writes, I'm not sure, he says, I know that it is true, but I never post by the idea, maybe pass by the idea, that women are looking to find a mate based on economics. If I were in the market, I would hide my walls so that people do not choose me for that reason.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've met a couple of guys who lie in the opposite direction on income. So the statistics are very clear on this. On average, men are inflating their incomes, and that's a rational thing to do because on average, women care about income. Women are attracted to everything else equal. Women are clearly attracted to men who make more money, at least at the date. Well, no, at every stage of the relationship, the data are clear on that. I'm not making a.
The data also show that men are more attracted to women who are, prettier, lovelier, have those externalities.
It's sort of a sad truth that the data are just very clear that they speak loudly to your stereotype notion that men care about looks and women care about money. I mean, the data, that's true. You can't get around that.
It's hard for those who feel that they're feminist-minded or, you know, contemporary in terms of enlightenment to accept. But
having said that, if you're willing to therefore focus your market on women who aren't interested in money, then Walter's right. You separate those people by either downplaying your income or ignoring the issue.
Again, we're talking, if you just joined us, with Paul Oyer, Stanford professor of economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, author of Everything I Needed to Know About Economics. I learned from online dating, and feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 is our phone number. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Well, let's go to another Palo Alto caller. Carol, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I am actually married for the second time to my husband. So, but the 10 years that we were apart, we dated, and I used Match.com, and it was a disaster because pretty much every guy on there had a picture that was so out of date that when I'd meet them, the first words out of my mouth were, "Wow, you don't really look like your picture."
Well, in many instances, it was the son or the nephew's picture that was being
captured. Yeah, I think so. But I'm home today cooking a Valentine's dinner for dear friends of ours who met through us and are now engaged. And I honestly think that the best way to meet somebody is through people that you know, because your friends know who you are and they know you well, and they know what you value. And that's a great way to get connected.
I like what you're saying, Carol, because I think, again, we're going back to data here. We're using a lot of data here, the economists and the talkos, but it shows that most people don't necessarily meet through online dating. I mean, in terms of enduring relationship, they meet usually at work or through friends.
Well, and that's absolutely right. And for online dating worked great for me. And for Carol suggested, and I think she's right, that a lot of people, you have private information, your friends have private information about who you would fit well with. And so they're, to use an economics term, they're good intermediaries for helping make those matches, just the way references are very – one of the best way to find good employees is to use references of your current employees. So these – that the underlying idea of setting up your friends makes a lot of sense. Now, having said that, I preferred online dating to having my friends fix me up. And the reason for that is I always found – then going back to my friends if that didn't work out when they fixed me up with someone, so awkward and painful that for me that was more that didn't overcome the benefits of the fact that they might have information about who I should be fixed up with. Now, I'm also curious. I assume Carol didn't meet her husband the second time around on Match.com. That would have been pretty funny if they got back together through Match.com.
It was 10 years later, and I think she just decided to marry him again for whatever reason. But I'm talking about mendacity, you know, about people lying or inflating or shading the truth and all. And people certainly, again, the analogy to the job market, they do that on CVs. The numbers, U.S. News and World Report have done studies of this, are absolutely extraordinary in terms of fudging and the like. But also, you mentioned references, and even in the job market sometimes, you really can't rely on a reference because people are afraid of litigation. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, mm-hmm. they don't necessarily give a bad, but they give a more neutral thing because mm-hmm. The person has been difficult and they don't want to go into the specifics.
Yeah. No, references, obviously we can't use references, and we talked about the one site where you can do it, and there are limits to using references in the online dating market, and I think one of the things that's made the job market a little less valuable or efficient than it used to be is litigation makes people worried, rightly. Or I think some people, by the way, I think people have misexpectations about the downsides of giving honest references. But whether rightly or wrongly, that leads to inefficiencies in the job market, and it's somewhat unfortunate.
I want to bring another caller on. Ryan, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm 26, living in San Francisco, and was wondering if the research had done any info or research into some of the new dating sites that are coming up, more local-based, like either Tinder or one that you mentioned before that a lot of good relationships come from mutual friends is Coffee Meets Bagel, where you connect with Facebook, and it randomly sends you a mutual friend that you both have via Facebook to meet with.
Familiar with them, Paul?
I'm familiar with them. I didn't have any personal interaction with these for two reasons. One is back when I was actively involved in online dating, I don't think these sites even existed. And second of all, as Ryan points out, they go to a younger demographic. And I think they're moving they're having an influence. Now
they're changing the business model somewhat.
They're
too.
Changing the business model, but they're aimed at a younger demographic, I think, because they're not as focused on long-term relationships. And that's fine. I mean, if you're younger, you shouldn't be as focused on looking for a long-term relationship. You should, you know, you need to learn about yourself and figure out what does and doesn't work. And so if it leads to a long-term relationship, the option value of it leading to one is good and valuable. So these sites can lead to long-term relationships. But I think sort of breaking the market down somewhat by age makes perfect sense.
Well, Ryan, I thank you for the call. And actually, off of his call, I think Barbara from Santa Rosa has something in the other age demographic. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, it's actually Abra, but I have a weird name. So my grandmother, who is 86, has been online dating for the past 10 years and been very, very successful. She's had two long-term relationships come out of a site, JDate. We are Jewish, and so is she. And I think the reason why her demographic, or her, an example, has been so successful is because she's using it as a site to get dates. She doesn't comb through and think that they're going to be a perfect long-term match. She sees if they're the right age and in her area and then willing to go out for lunch or coffee or dinner to see if the connection is there in person. She doesn't email. She doesn't text. And I think that has been extremely successful for her in meeting people because she meets them face-to-face as soon as possible.
Okay, that's a great suggestion. So two things. One is congratulations to her because in her demographic, the supply-demand thing is just a disaster. The 86-year-old market is very tilted towards available women. And so the fact that she's been successful at finding long-term relationships at her age is great. I like this idea of just going out to meet people. And as an economist, this is going to sound so rational, you're going to think I'm being really ridiculous now. But as an economist, we think about you want to search optimally. And when you're 86, you want to be less picky than when you're 25. Because the amount of, if you're going to end up being lonely, or as I like to say, romantically unemployed, that's a, if it takes a few months to find somebody when you're 86, that's a much bigger cost than when you're young. So I think her strategy is a great one. And I'm really impressed that it's been so successful given the supply-demand issues at her age.
Thank you for the call, Abra. And here's an email from Joanne who says, okay, I'm going to go on record as a woman who does care about looks. And Sean asks, isn't one of the issues with businesses such as Facebook, Twitter, and Airbnb, which arise from the network effect, that because of the inclination toward growth merely by more consumers joining, that it can lead to paucity of continued innovation?
I think so. Taking those in order, women do care about looks, just less on average than men. And Joanna might care as much as any man, and that's fine. People have different preferences. Everything we've talked about is an average, not by any means true for all people of any gender we're talking about. On the second question, sure. I mean, if a site becomes very successful in generating the network externality we talked about, so if you're Facebook, for example, and you're so successful and it would be almost impossible for anybody to change, you have less incentive to innovate and keep your site going well. Now, you know, change. There's enough going on out there that Facebook has Facebook looks down the road and knows that someday they could be displaced. So they are innovating. But whether they're doing it as much, or eBay as well, which is also innovating, but it has these network externalities, I don't know if the, you're right. The network externalities can lead to, could stifle innovation. I don't think that's been a huge problem yet, though.
Eva from Napa Valley, let's get you on here quick. Hi.
Hi. I just started doing a little experiment between the status of each man, whether they earn between $50,000 to $100,000 and $100,000 above. And I found it, the characteristic between the two is so different, and the way they talk, the way they express themselves, and what turns me on and turns me off when they state their economic status makes a big difference. And I myself, to be honest, I like to have it a little bit more on the higher side just because of how our economic status
is. Oh, just remember, Eva, what Fitzgerald has said to Hemingway, the rich are different than you and me. and Hemingway said, yes, they have more money. Thank you, and thank you, Paul Oyer, for being with us. The book, again, is Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. It's time again for our listener mailbag segment when we read from your comments and feedback. We try to do that every other Thursday. And let's start with a show that struck a chord with a lot of our listeners, our conversation with the founders of The Dinner Party, a group that builds community among people who have experienced the death of a loved one. Allison shared this perspective. I lost my sister, who I was very close to, when she was 42 and I was a year older. We've been very close our whole life. There is joy in speaking of her. I think the effort to give people a way to process their loss in a dinner format sounds quite wonderful. In general, our society is not very good at it. They expect people to get over their grief way too fast. Thank you, Allison. And another emotional show that resonated with our listeners was our interview with California Highway Patrol Sergeant John Carman, who works to reduce suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge. During the show, we heard from a caller who shared her story of interacting with a potential jumper on the bridge.
And I said, I love you. What is your name? I love you. Just hold on me. I'm not going to push you. And I was, I don't know why, I kept repeating this until she just took my hand. I actually took her wrist and held on her until somebody came over.
And Faye, one of our listeners, had this response. The caller today said she loved the woman over the railing and kept repeating it. Amazing. Those can be powerful words, even coming from a complete stranger, that intrude on the thought pattern. Depression is so desperate, it takes powerfully heartfelt words to cut through the roar of the mind. And in the wake of Philip Seymour Hoffman's alleged overdose, we dedicated an hour to exploring the efficacy of drug abuse treatments. And Matt sent in this comment. I realize that opiate painkillers are being abused in this state. However, there are people out there who need them to live pain-free, are able to function in society perfectly well, and most importantly, are under the care of a physician. My own relative lives with a chronic nerve condition and has taken a low-dose narcotic pill for 10 years without any problems. These medications can be life-saving, and they should not be stigmatized. And many listeners were unhappy with our show about separating artists' behavior from their art. The show focused on Dylan Farrow's recent op-ed that alleged sexual abuse by her adoptive father, Woody Allen. Wayne wrote, "I am aghast at the tone of the forum program on separating art from the artist. This show had a clear presumption of guilt. The show targeted a single artist, Woody Allen, though there was token reference to other artists, though more accused of something, not accused of something as heinous as child molestation. I have seldom witnessed a clearer example of character assassination. I am very disappointed in KQED's handling of this subject." And lastly, a note from yesterday's show with Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Anonymous listener wrote, "I'm a mom of a 2.5-year-old as well as a 1-year-old with special needs, and I just wanted to say that the ups and downs of parenting become even higher and lower when you have a child who is not developing typically. We have greater challenges and emotional tests, but also the ongoing gift of not taking all of the usual milestones and measures of development for granted. As a result, we can appreciate every small success along the way. It's a different road than parenting children who don't face the same challenges." Thank you to all of our listeners who continually share their perspective, their own highs and lows, as well as feedback on our programming. All of our shows are archived at kqed.org, and we're always listening by email. Our address is kqed.org/forum. And again, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. We remind you that you can let us know also what you think about what you hear on forum or would like to hear by going to that email address, kqed.org/forum. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Jack Detch, Marissa Endicott, Mayim Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Danielle Radin. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.